copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Art and the Big Questions of Life. I'm, as you've heard from that biography, I'm, to borrow the words of Amos, neither an artist nor the son of an artist, but I believe God has just given me a love for art, an eye for the aesthetic, and over the years I've come to make friends with a number of artists who have taught me a great deal, and particularly among them is Liviu Mocan here. And while in Romania as well, living the 11 years there, I began to collect a number of works of art, sculptures and paintings, and which have really enriched my life and my ministry ever since. So let me tell you then about how I've learned to collaborate with artists, particularly with Liviu, in a broader ministry that includes worldview and apologetics. So to start with, I wanted to talk about art as a tin opener. And in the city of Krakow, which many of you have been through just to get here, in 1994, I visited the city and discovered an amazing basement cafe. And around the mahogany dinner tables or kind of coffee tables, under the dimly lit vaults, young Poles were talking about, well, I had no idea what they were talking about, but I imagined that they were talking about how are we adapting to this completely new world. Communism had come to an end just a few years before, and they were having to make sense of the huge changes that were taking place in their society, in their lives, and so on. And at that time, I was working with Youth for the Mission, with their Relief and Development Ministry in Switzerland, and I'd come to discover how extremely important a biblical worldview is on kind of every aspect of life and of work and so on. And this understanding of worldview had already begun to transform my own professional understanding of poverty and development that I was working in. But while I was sitting in that cafe in Krakow, I believe God planted a seed in my heart, just reflecting on that experience. And the seed involved two words, really, which were worldview cafe. And I imagined, well, a worldview cafe, I guess, is a place where people could try and make sense of the different worldviews that are kind of bombarding them, the East and the West, and could ideally could be a place where people might explore, well, what does the Bible say? How does the Bible give us a vision for all of life and society? And how could that give a future and a hope to people in the post-communist world? I mean, this is nearly 25 years ago. And I thought, that's a great, I'm going to take hold of that vision, a worldview cafe. The only problem was, I had no idea what a worldview cafe really was or how to start one, as I had not had any background in business, and I liked coffee, but I had no idea how to make a proper espresso at that time. So what happened then? There was 18 months later, after that visit, I'd got married to my lovely wife, Helen, and we found ourselves at a big YWAM gathering in Switzerland. We worked with Youth for the Mission for many years. And a local Swedish Christian artist called Jan-Erik Johansson had been invited to this conference to bring a few of his paintings and to talk to us about how his art and his work and his life were fitting together. And he had some extraordinary paintings and talked about how he brought his understanding of the gospel and of the Bible into his paintings. But they were of ladybirds, they were of horses, and there was this one in particular which I loved, which really captured our imagination. And he asked us a load of questions, and I could see how bringing art into a conference of just a whole random group of young people working with Youth of the Mission could really transform the way they discussed and engaged with one another. And so he really gave us a masterclass in how to use art to engage people holistically. Now, over the next few years, we began to realize how art might play a key role in this worldview cafe, which still didn't exist. providing kind of visual parables. See, what this is, if you can see it kind of well enough, is that, it would be helpful, could we just turn the light off so we can see this one more clearly? It was just two vertical sort of tableaus. Can you get the one off these two here? That's cool. One had just a 7 on it, and the other one we worked out had 77s on it. But just placing up there in front of us and asking us what we saw and so on, he got us to realize that you can take a work of art like this, and it can have an overt meaning, a kind of an obvious meaning, but it can also have a sort of a second deeper level of meaning. And of course, this one is about forgiveness, because Jesus says, well, he was asked by Peter, how many times should I forgive my brother? As many as 7 times? And Jesus says, no, not 7 times, but how many? 70 times 7. And so you get the contrast between human kind of capacity for forgiveness and divine capacity for forgiveness in a very visual way. And so that was we went away with that thinking, could our Worldview Cafe somehow use artwork that works like a parable? See, when Jesus told parables, there was an everyday story about something in life, about sheep on the, you know, outside Jerusalem, whatever. But he turned that into, there was a message about the kingdom of God in there as well. And we thought, can we have works of art like this one, which on the surface, yeah, has nice patterns of sevens, but for people who were asked a question about it, say, what lies behind that? There'd be this sort of second level of meaning. And so we asked for permission to copy this painting, which we did, from Jan Erik, and it was one of the first things on the wall of our cafe, which we finally opened. It was about 10 years after I got that vision, and it was a great long story, but we finally opened the cafe in Cluj in Romania in January 2004. And we had a few permanent works like that, one of the sevens. But with the university art faculty just across the road from our cafe, we began to invite artists to come and hold their exhibitions. For several art students, it was the first chance they had of a solo exhibition. So we could really bless the art community there. But we also invited established artists to display their works. And one event taught me a great deal. It was an exhibition we organized called Minority Report. And and at the time, by the way, when you'd hold an exhibition, an art exhibition in Romania, and it might still be the case, that generally an art critic is invited to come along to wax eloquently, we say in English, to say some wonderful words about the exhibition, and the artists just sit quietly at the back and sort of try and look pleased. But we said, no, we want to do it differently. We want to let the artists have a few words, even though a number of artists, they paint because they can't speak. But we asked them, would you like to say a few words anyway? And this is what we did with the Minority Report. Romania is predominantly Romanian ethnically, but there are a number of minorities, and particularly in the city of Cluj where we were, there's a number of Hungarians, maybe up to 20% of the population there were ethnic Hungarians, and there were Germans, there was a small Jewish population, and one or two others. And so we asked a number of members of these minority ethnic groups just to bring a work of art, a painting of theirs that we could put up, and to say a couple of words about it. Well, the room was packed out, and one of the first questions was from a Romanian girl called Cami. She was the graphic designer who worked with us, and she asked this question of the Hungarian artist. She said, when I was at the art faculty, when I was a student, I found that my Hungarian colleagues would often express a lot more violence in their paintings, in their works. Do you feel somehow the same way? And of course, this is a complete taboo. How can you raise that kind of question in a public meeting about ethnicity, violence, minorities, majorities? It was extraordinary. And yet, because we were talking about works of art, it just opened up. And within a few minutes, we found complete strangers were talking about their own feelings regarding their ethnicity. That was extraordinary. We thought, there's no way you could have engineered this. There's no way you could have asked people, hey, can you please now tell this group of people, well, how do you feel about being a minority? Unless they were political activists and doing that all the time. But these weren't. These were ordinary people. And so we realized art can be this tin opener. It can open something that is normally closed. It can access a place in people's hearts, in their minds, and open them up to share and to talk, to engage. And this really was, it was remarkable, because we found that there, just after that event, there was an art critic in the room. This is the actual event, and he stood up at the end and he said, "I've been to more than 100 art exhibitions, but none of them has compared to this one for its warmth and its atmosphere." And there was something remarkable that God just gave us in this kind of approach to using art. So we began to see how art can be subversive, how it can has this way of getting past people's kind of rational or intellectual defenses and to reach their heart or their soul like a divine tin opener. And the same thing happened a couple of years later when we did an exhibition called Emigration. The way we did it was like this. We invited people. We gave them 1 week. We said, we're going to have a competition to create a poster on emigration. And Romania is a country that has sent huge numbers of emigrants to other countries around Europe. And we didn't know what would happen. But we said, we'll give you €100 prize for the best poster. And you got 1 week to come up with a poster. Well, we had no idea how many would come, but there were over 70 entries. We covered the walls with these posters. And it was, once again, we saw the divine tin opener at work, because here were a bunch of students, artists, others who weren't artists at all, but they wanted to say something about emigration. And it opened up this complex interplay between the lack of hope people felt about living in Romania or their job prospects, how that drove them to emigrate, and yet how emigration split families and opened up deep wells of sorrow. And all these emotions and the economic side of it, the practical side of it, were wrapped up and were displayed through these extraordinary posters. So now maybe This was my learning. I'm sharing my journey of learning. You are artists, and perhaps all this is you know already, but I was so excited to discover the kind of power that art can have to open people up. The second point I want to make is about how art is a character reference. So this cafe that we opened, here it is. I mean, you can't see the beauty of it, but we loved making it and creating it. But we came to realize, at first, we realized, okay, we've got to make a cafe. It's going to be a place where we can get people to think about different worldviews. So it was a long journey, as I say. It took 10 years from when we first got this word, Worldview Cafe, till we opened. But we learned along the way, first of all, that we wanted to create a place that would encourage and facilitate discussion about these big questions of life. Secondly, we had learned that art can be an amazing way to do it. But at that time, we were just thinking, well, art, it'll be like a tool, an instrument to get people to talk and open up and so on. But then when we realized we had to actually begin a business, we had to start a cafe business, that's when it started to get more sort of challenging. So we thought, well, how do we go about starting a business in a way that shows and demonstrates this biblical worldview that we want to get people to explore? Well, that's how we got to think about and reflect on how do you actually bring this approach to art into creating a space, a physical space like a cafe. And we learned three things. Firstly, it has to be the best. When you read about God's instructions for making the tabernacle or building the temple in the Old Testament, you realize that God only wants the best and is not honored by half-hearted work. And if you think right back to Cain and Abel and the difference between the two of them, one brought the best and the other one was half-hearted. So we hired out some of the best interior designers in Cluj. They were not Christians, most of them, but we went for the ones who seemed to be the best artists. And then we had a really interesting experience of working with them, because the guy in charge was a complete scoundrel. But anyway, we ended up with some of the really best decor. And in terms of furniture, we also scrapped our sort of, well, what's the least we can get away with? And we increased our budget. We said, we've got to spend more and make the best. And so we got some local artisans to make wrought iron chairs and tables. Again, it needed to really be the best. Secondly, we learned that it has to be comprehensive. Every part of the venue needed to reflect this approach to the reflecting the character of God and the value of beauty and the value of design. There shouldn't be any gaps. And so a couple of points I made, I said, I want our toilets to be the best in the city. I want people to really come into here because they find the toilets really lovely, not just clean, but aesthetic and pleasing and so on. And I made a point as the owner, as the owner of the cafe, to always use the not the staff toilet, but I always use the customer toilet so that my staff knew that that's what I was expecting. And secondly, we had to make an interesting, you made this comment just a minute ago, Charles, about not doing sort of things we have to do in a boring way. Every business in Romania had to put a sign up saying, you are obliged to ask for a receipt for your purchase and keep it with you till you leave the shop. And most people, they just type out the words, print it on a piece of white paper and stick it on the wall, which is, of course, really ugly. So we thought, no, let's make this part of the work of the decor. And so we printed it on our handmade paper, the same as the menu, put a lovely frame around it. We used the same design elements that we are using for the best. We used it for the mundane as well. So there was nothing that was in the whole cafe that, you know, we covered up the regular refrigerator, you know, with its plain white sides. We put a nice sort of boarding around that, painted it, and so on. So there was nothing that did not somehow include this, or nothing outside the scope of this bringing art and design and beauty into every part, in order to show what kind of God, what kind of worldview this we were talking about. So, anyway, I need to move on to talk about the next big project we did. So, getting to know Liviu in Romania, outside his studio stood this study. And it was just sitting on the doorstep of his studio. And I asked him earlier, I said, well, what is this exactly? And he said, it's one of the Ten Commandments, as if that was obvious. I said, really? That's one of the Ten Commandments? Which one? He said, oh, no. And he explained how on the one side is the smooth side, and it's supposed to be like God's, like a finger. And the other side is sharp, ugly, rusty metal. He said, I want to make 10 of these columns, put them in a circle, so that when you go inside, you see only the warm side, and it's like being held in God's hands. And the other side, if you're outside the circle, you come across the commands, God's commandments, in a way that are ugly, they're painful, they cut you, there's a real warning there. And as I was involved in worldview teaching and ministry, I found this an extremely interesting illustration of how God's law works, and different things like that how the commands were supposed to create this safe place within which we can live and enjoy God's love. And it says 10 times in the book of Deuteronomy, if you keep my commands, it will go well with you. And Liviu kind of caught hold of this, and he wanted to create a physical space inside the circle where it goes well with you. You could feel that sense of the blessing that comes through obeying God's commands. But on the outside, you encounter them as a warning, as a sign of judgment. You know that, and somebody once said, "We don't break God's laws so much as God's laws break us." So I went around telling people in my teaching about worldview about this wonderful sculpture that didn't exist. Well, that's all it was. But I asked Liviu, I said, Liviu, when are you going to make it? And he said, well, I'm just waiting for the right time and the right place. Well, fast forward a few years, and I had by this time left Romania and was working in Switzerland in the city of Geneva. And this, you can't quite see, but this is the Reformers' Wall in Geneva, in the Central Park. Have any of you been there to this amazing wall of the Reformation? And we'd started to work amongst the international community of Christians in Geneva, again helping them to connect with Geneva's spiritual heritage, and the Reformation played a really big part of this of that heritage. And particularly, there was John Calvin, who helped to transform, by the grace of God, the city of Geneva from one of the smelliest towns in Europe, it was at the time, to a model city-state, which was known for its stability, its order, its prosperity, and its justice, all in one generation. It was an incredible story of Geneva at the time of the Reformation. So in the park, next to the old medieval city, is this monument of the Reformation, acknowledging the roles played by Calvin and three other reformers in the spread of the Reformation throughout Europe and on to elsewhere. If you don't recognize them, the guy on the left is Guillaume Farel. He was the French evangelist who brought the gospel to Geneva. Then there's Calvin. Then there's Calvin's successor, Theodore de Beze. And finally, John Knox, the Scotsman who took refuge in Geneva. And then he took back to Scotland the Reformation. And from Scotland, it went on, and particularly to North America and so on. Anyway, a few months after I arrived in Geneva, I was on a prayer walk in this park, walking past this monument. And I believe it, I say this very rarely, but I think the Lord spoke to me there and then, saying, this is where that Decalogue sculpture should stand. And I thought, well, that would be nice, wouldn't it? But, you know, this is Geneva. It's a nice idea, but it kept coming back to me with more and more insistence, and I began to wonder if maybe the Lord was in it. So I contacted Liviu and said, Liviu, remember the Decalogue sculpture? Have you made it yet? No, he said. Well, he said, would you mind making it here in Switzerland and in Geneva? And I told him the story and I explained, and after several conversations we agreed that if the Lord would provide a place and the funding to make it, and that would be my responsibility to do that, he would make the sculpture, which would be his responsibility. And so that's what we did. And a year and a half later, that's where it stood, in the Parc des Bastions, in the center of Geneva. But it was quite a journey on the way. We had to deal with some serious setbacks. The first, of course, was when we went to say, you know, you don't go around and say, would you like a monumental sculpture in your city? And we talked to one or two Christians who were in the parks and working in the public sort of place in the city of Geneva, and they said, no, forget it. You know, the city is full of sculptures already. Every embassy who's got, you know, the United Nations offices here, they all want to give sculptures by their favorite, you know, national sculptor to the city of Geneva. No way, the place is full. So we said, well, Lord, you know, if you've spoken, if you want this sculpture to be here, then would you provide a place? You know, how will you do that? And so what happened was, we ended up meeting the person who was running the Calvin celebrations in 2009. And I started to realize that, okay, this is going to be a big celebration for the city of Geneva, the 500th anniversary of Calvin's birth. And I began to look and see, actually, there's some really great links between Calvin and the Ten Commandments, the Decalogue. So I went to see the priest who was running the celebrations. I said, would you like a great big sculpture as part of your celebrations? And he said, and when I shared the vision for it, he said, well, that is amazing, because we really wanted something that would leave a lasting impact, a lasting impression. Not just, you know, 1 month of activities he was planning, but something that would speak to people for many, many years ahead. So he began to help us look for a place. But along came another major problem with the fundraising. We needed about 300,000 euros, we thought, to create to create this in, cast it in bronze. But this is now September 2008, and a little event took place across in America. The collapse of Lehman Brothers Bank, the financial crisis took hold, and it was not a good time to raise a large amount of money for any kind of project, certainly not an art project. And so we said, well, Lord, how are we going to do this? And again, to cut a long story short, Livy said, he was inspired to come back and say, do you know what? We could make it in fiberglass. Instead of casting it in bronze, we can make it in fiberglass and coat it in gold leaf. And that's what he did in the end. These are fiberglass covered in gold leaf. Of course, it would cost one-tenth of making it in bronze, and it would be portable. And that's the agreement we came to with the guy organizing the Calvin celebrations. He said, I can give you a space in that park, but only for 1 month. Can you bring it and take it away in a month? And so that was what happened. The Lord provided this the space for a month, but we ended up actually holding... this is the team of us that brought it together. Oh, I should tell you about the money. The guy in the middle is a Swiss businessman. He's a property developer in Geneva. And as we were looking for the funding, a friend of mine who knew this guy in the middle, he said, go and see Stefan. Maybe he'd be interested. So I went to see him, talked about the project, and he said, yeah, maybe. But I gave him a copy of a DVD, a film that had been made by some people in the States, a beautiful film on Liviu's work and his family and his ministry. It's a very, very effective film, beautiful, beautiful piece of filmmaking. So I gave it to Stefan, and he said, oh, well, I'll take a look, get back in touch after 2 weeks. So I went to see him 2 weeks later, and I sat him down, and he said, almost right away, he said, I've watched the film, God has spoken to me, I want to be involved in this. How much money do you need? And he ended up giving us 50,000 Swiss francs, which was pretty much what we needed to make the sculptures. So the Lord brought us together to create this extraordinary exhibition, which went from Geneva. This is the unveiling. After 1 month, it spent in that park in central Geneva. It then spent 2 months outside the World Council of Churches in Geneva, then outside a church, a Reformed church, for about 9 months. Then in 2010, it went across to the States, spent a few weeks in a suburb of Hollywood, of Los Angeles. From there, it went to Grand Rapids in Michigan. Livy went around for each unveiling. This is the unveiling in Calvin College, which was the last place it spent a year. In Calvin College, Grand Rapids. Just quickly, a few more things, because what this is about, what we were learning through this, and we are learning it now, and Livy is going to talk after the break about the Cambridge project for the five solas of the Reformation. But we, in creating this public sculpture, sitting in the park, as it did in Switzerland, so this one here in Geneva's Central Park, we had to find a way to talk about, to bring together the history, because this is about the history of Geneva. It was about the Ten Commandments, and it was about Calvin as a person. It had to make sense to all three of those things. So we made a leaflet, and I've just got that upstairs, but the leaflet was absolutely key to make it available next to the sculpture, so that, because people came and just looking at it, you won't know that it's about the Ten Commandments. We had to give a key to people so that they could then get into something of the heart of what this is about. So we called the title of the sculpture was Invitation/Decalogue. Because we wrote about four invitations that this sculpture talks about. It was an invitation to relationship. The idea of you're coming into God's hands to know God, to know His peace. So there's an invitation to relationship. An invitation to reflect on the nature of law. And the kind of the positive side, it goes well when you keep it. The negative side, it goes badly when you break it. Certainly an invitation to freedom, because we said you're free to walk in and out of that circle. We have a freedom to obey God's laws or not. There's this moral freedom and responsibility, but we're not free to choose the consequences of whether we live inside and out. So there's this sense of freedom, but it's a limited kind of a freedom. And lastly, an invitation to hope, because we talked about how when institutions are crumbling, as they were in the financial crisis, when marriages break down, when there are all kinds of problems within in society, we invited people to come back to this, what has been a source of hope and of building societies, building marriages, building lives, building communities for thousands of years, that has lasted the test of time. And we invited people to consider the hope which God's word brings. So in the leaflet, it talked about these four different kinds of invitation, and we began just a few words for each. The first, we began with the spiritual meaning around why is it an invitation to relationship, how are the commands an invitation to relationship, and then secondly, we showed how each of them was incorporated into Calvin's teachings. It was the Calvin anniversary, and then in the subsequent history of Geneva. So it was an exercise, and that's what I was doing, was writing how do we thread these things together to make a coherent message so that this work of art can take people into the theology, into the historical commemoration, and into our present situation. How can we weave those three things together? And that is the real challenge and the opportunity that is there in creating these works of art. So, as I say, it ended up across in the States, and it's available for anyone who'll pay the transport and for a new coat of gold leaf.
So, Jonathan, you would say that again, the famous phrase that many artists would say, the art just speaks for itself, that's not adequate, is it?
It is not. It does speak. People would come and say all sorts of things like, wow, this is inspired by a Buddhist temple, isn't it? You know, and say, no, actually. And others would say, wow, it's like this incredible plant coming up. And other people said, oh, it looks like dragon's claws. And so, you know, people had all sorts of interpretations of their own. But we didn't want to spell it out too much. But we wanted to give people enough if they were willing. As a key, so it's a key. It's not the whole story. So that, I think that's our challenge: was how do you pitch it just at the right level? So now we are in 2017, and my last point is I'm calling it art as incarnation. You know, God incarnates all His great ideas. He gives physical form to the universe itself. Is the expression of a grand idea for matter and for, well, all the different building blocks of the universe. The human race is God's incredible idea of people to bear His image and His likeness. And the one we usually call the incarnation is, of course, Jesus Christ, God Himself becoming one of us to reveal His ideas. So I think there's this great challenge of how can we turn ideas into, how can we incarnate them, how can we give them physical form? And this was a challenge that was put to me about 4 or 5 years ago by YWAM's European director, who said, how are you planning to mark the 500th anniversary of the Reformation in 2017? What are you going to do? And I thought, oh, it would be fantastic to do this, because the Reformation has had such an extraordinary impact, not just on the church. Obviously, it gave birth to the Protestant church, but the Reformation ended up having an enormous impact on the culture, on the education, on science, on the economy, on literature, on so many aspects of European civilization through the Reformation. And I thought, this is such an amazing idea, how God's wisdom and how His word can transform nations, can transform societies. But how do you take 95 theses, and this is, you know, the first however many of them there are, in Latin, as Luther wrote them originally. How do you take this this set of words, 95 theses, and form an idea out of them. That's what I began to think about. But the first thing I realized was, if we're going to have any kind of big event in 2017, we need a website and we need a domain name. So I went and Googled, okay, what domain can I get? I found reformation2017.org was available. So I bought it quickly in 2013 before anyone else got there. And sure enough, a couple of years later, the Lutheran Church in Germany wrote to me, are you going to use this domain name? We would like to buy it from you, please.
How much?
I said, so not. They offered me 500 euros. I said, no, sorry, we've got it for something. I don't know quite what yet, but we have got it for something. And so the Lord, in last year, kind of brought the pieces together, and we've created on this website, which you can visit it, we are doing a project to crowdsource 95 theses for today. And they're not about how to reform the church, but it's about how can Christians be a reforming influence in the world. What are some of the big issues in the world that we would like to see changed? So that's the main focus of the website. But we also have planned and set up a whole program of events in Cambridge and some new research. But all this is rather words-based. And Livia called me last September and said, hey, Jonathan, I think I've got an idea for a sculpture for the Reformation. What about the five solas? And we began to have a talk and a conversation around it. And I thought, wow, this is fantastic, because here's the five solas are these big ideas which summarize the theology of the Reformation. And yet they are Latin phrases which no one can understand. So how can we enter the spirit and the meaning of those five solas? And so that is what we've been doing ever since. And we did the same deal. I've got to come up with the money and the place, and Livy's got to come up with the five sculptures. And we're both finding it a real challenge. But the Lord provided a place, amazingly, from the very beginning, outside the church, which was the university church in the center of Cambridge, which is where the Reformation was focused on 500 years ago. It's amazing. It's the perfect place in Cambridge. And the priest in charge of that church, he's absolutely, completely supportive of the project and is really helping us. So we got a great place. We need a budget of £46,000. That's about sort of 50,000 euros. And we're almost halfway there. And we need the other half, but Livia is also halfway there in making them, and so it's a race to see who's going to finish first, Livia or me. Anyway, to conclude, this is how they perhaps will look in opposite King's College Chapel. That you can just see it in the background, the iconic King's College Chapel in Cambridge. And one of the English reformers, Thomas Cranmer, said, what the heart loves, the will chooses, and the mind justifies. That was 500 years ago. We've been through, since then, the Enlightenment, modernity, and we think that for a couple of hundred years, we thought that reason is going to lead us to truth, but we're seeing that fail now. We're on the far side of modernity. We're in post-modernity. And in this culture today, images are more important than ever. We live in an increasingly visual age. And so through this Five Foundations exhibition, we're bringing together a historical commemoration, a public sculpture, and a theological message. And we've discovered that such exhibitions have the ability to connect the past, the present, and the eternal in a way that can help people to discover the reality of the great artist and the Lord Jesus, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So that's our ministry. That's what we're trying to do. Please pray for us, and thank you very much for listening. Thank you.